Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guest today had a 30-year career as a wildlife protection officer for the California Department of Fish and Game. Steve Callan and his working partners conducted some of the most fascinating, complex, and highly successful wildlife investigations in California history. Along the way, he collected a trove of true stories, action-packed, suspenseful, and often humorous. He was hired by the California Department of Fish and Game in 1974, and he transferred to Shasta County in 1981 and spent the rest of his enforcement career in Redding. Steve Callan's first book, Badges, Bears, and Eagles, was selected as a 2013 Book of the Year finalist by Forward Reviews. He earned the 2014 and 2015 Best Outdoor Magazine Column Awards from the Outdoor Writers Association of California. His book, Badges, Bears, and Eagles, sold out at the Chico Costco when he had a book signing there in 2013. And tomorrow, Steve Callan will be at the Chico Costco with his new book, The Game Warden's Son. Steve Callan, welcome.
Thank you very much, Nancy.
Well, you have written your second book now, and you have it in chronological order by decades. But I would like to jump to a story in your book that happens in the fall of 1986. And I don't think people realize that game wardens do stakeouts, like policemen do. And it might not be daytime. In fact, it's often nighttime. So why don't you tell us about the stakeout at Battle Creek?
This was one of my more enjoyable investigations. I was in the office one day at the Fish and Game office in Redding, and a phone call came in from the one of the employees at Coleman's National Fish Hatchery, which is on Battle Creek and up in the Redding area. And he said that right down by the weir where they stop the salmon that come up, where they lead them into the hatchery, the last few nights they had discovered that somebody had come in and actually taken some of the fish. And when they take them out of the water, the eggs fall out all over the bank. And this was a pretty common situation. And so the warden that actually took the call, I happened to be in the office at the time. I was his supervisor, and we both decided, let's go out and investigate. So we went out to the hatchery, and the employee there showed us where all the evidence was. And
so that's why when they spilled the eggs there, that's the evidence that,
right,
somebody's been up to something here.
And it was pretty obvious that you could see right down below the weir where they had come up the bank, and you could see the eggs, and then I could also see where something had been dragged along the ground. And there's a long kind of a meadow at the time, 200 or 300 yards, that would go out to a gate. And it, usually if the poachers came in, that's the way they came in and went and left. And so we decided, well, maybe it's time for us to do a stakeout, because the people live on the hatchery during all the time. So at night's the only time that these poachers would be safe coming in there. And so what we did is this other officer and I set up a stakeout, and what we decided to do is he would sit in his truck there in the hatchery, and I would sit on the hill by this gate where the poachers usually came in, and I would alert him by radio when somebody came in. And so what happened is the first—
I mentioned that this is 1986.
1986.
Those, for people who are wondering,
yes,
well, why didn't you just call on cell phone?
Yeah, yes. Yeah, there's a lot of things different than 1986. In fact, I don't think we even had cell phones then. But so I sat up there basically all night on the hill above this gate.
And this is fall now, October, so
this
it's
pretty
chilly. Yeah,
fall of October, 86. And
October is a pretty chilly at night.
And that was the time of the year when most of the salmon were, the fall run salmon were, they were just stacked up in the creek. There were lots and lots of fish. And so it's a real temptation for some of the posters. We had that happen almost every year.
In fact, Steve, I was kind of amused at myself, because if you say poached salmon to me,
right,
I think about, tasty.
Yes.
And when you think poached salmon, you think, uh-oh, somebody's up no good.
One that took the fish illegally. There are lots of ways to do that. But anyway, these guys—
lots of ways to poach salmon.
Right. And so what happens, the first night I sat there and basically I was sitting there all night, never had a thing happen and tell them.
And that's what, so you go out there at 11 o'clock at night and you sit there, it's dark. How do you keep from falling asleep?
Well, you try not to, and you're sitting on the side of a hill trying to keep from falling off this steep hill. And just about daylight, what happened is I looked out into this field, and there's this. I started watching these pheasants. There was two rooster pheasants out in the middle of this meadow beyond the gate, and they're walking along, and then suddenly there's this gray fox, and I watched this fox, and the fox just looks at him, and you know, you expect the fox to try to sneak up on him.
Here's a canine and a bird.
One of these pheasants. Instead, the fox just says, well, I don't want anything to do with you, and he starts walking away. And these two rooster pheasants follow the fox all the way across the field and then up the bank right within 50 yards of where I am. And I'm watching this whole thing right at daylight. And pretty soon what they got, it's like the pheasants led them off the property. And then as soon as the fox was well out of sight, the pheasants flew back into the field and the fox disappeared. And I just told myself at the time, it's a perfect example of when you just stay in one place. If you want to see wildlife, find a good spot and just stay there. Don't try to follow them. And a lot of times they'll come to you. And so that was a pretty good example of that.
Well, and you sat there 6 hours, I believe you sat there.
Mm-hmm.
And you had this little scene take place there at the end of this stakeout at 6 hours. But I found that I can go sit by the creek. Now, it doesn't happen every day. Months go by. But in less than an hour, I have seen little dramas with a mother raccoon and her little one trailing along behind her. I can just imagine the conversation that's going on between mm-hmm. the two of them. I've seen river otters just playing so, and because I'm sitting there, I'm not trying to find them. They come to me. Beavers. And I knew when I read that sentence in your book, I thought, oh, I know exactly what Steve means, that you wrote, you never know what you're going to see if you remain still and let nature come to you.
Exactly. And I've had that happen so many times.
And it means that if you are sitting there hour after hour, you're sometimes rewarded for your patience.
Exactly. Which is that's something else I wrote in the book that every game warden knows that he needs to acquire a sense of patience, because that's a big part of the job.
I might remind listeners that my guest is Steve Callan, and on your book, the name is Stephen T. Callan. Maybe there's another Steve Callan somewhere that you had to distinguish yourself.
No, that's interesting. That's another story. But back in Maine, there's another one, and I didn't know that until I started writing books. So.
Okay, so Stephen T. Callan, if you wanted to Google or look up Steve and his books, Stephen T. Callan, and his book that we are discussing is The Game Warden's Son. And we haven't started talking about your dad yet, because I wanted people to hear what it's like, what a game warden does in the line of duty. And here you are, you've spent one night sitting out, and you were rewarded with this the fox and the pheasants, but you didn't catch the guys you were sitting out there to catch.
Well, I didn't that night, and so we weren't willing to give up. So we both went home and got some sleep, and then the following night, we did the exact same thing again. He sat in his car he probably slept in his car, but by the inside the hatchery there, and I went back to my spot on the hill, and then it was about 11 o'clock, somewhere around there, when a car pulls up, and these people there was a female driving, I could hear her voice, and then these two guys climbed out of the car, and one of the voices that I heard was something that I know I recognized the voice, but I wasn't sure where I was, where I had heard that voice before. But anyway, this person got, both of them got out of the car. I could hear them climbing over the gate, and they walked out. I could hear them walking out, as they walked out in the field. Both of them, I think, were intoxicated, because I could hear them, one of them threw a bottle, and they were laughing. And so time went by over the course of an hour or so, and they went out to the Battle Creek, and my partner was actually in position to where he could see them on the side of the bank and go down over the bank And a little bit later, they were coming up, and they came out with a couple gunny sacks full of salmon, which they had actually speared with a spear that they had already left there.
And that's what they're doing that is illegal.
Right. Well, it's that.
And that's why you're there.
Right. The creek at the time was closed to the take of salmon, period, but especially illegal to use a spear to take them. So anyway, we arranged, or when they got back to the car, I called the other officer in, and we trapped him there at the car with the driver, the getaway driver, and he came in a big van, and they had the van loaded down with salmon, and we ended up catching them all. And as it turned out, the individual whose voice I had recognized, I had arrested him before for deer poaching, and so that led to another story in that chapter. So,
well, now is this the now you change people's names? So since you're telling these stories,
right,
about people, is this the guy that you call Adamo?
Yes.
And I couldn't help but laugh, because here's this guy out doing something illegal, and what he said was, you ask him, well, why did you become a poacher? And he said, believe it or not, I always wanted to be a game warden. And if he always wanted to be a game warden, why didn't he become a game warden?
Well, based on his story, he could never pass the test. I have a feeling it was a physical test, because this person must have weighed 300 pounds.
In fact, I think that's why you didn't recognize him when you saw him.
Right.
Saw him before, he didn't.
He had gained quite a bit of weight since I had seen him before, twice before, as it turned out, once up on Shasta Lake in a houseboat, and another time when he was skinning the deer. So I had a long history with this individual.
And when he said he couldn't pass the test to become a game warden, you say, that's too bad. We could have saved a lot of wildlife. And he says, yeah, I would have made a great game warden.
Yeah, I remember that, because I said, no, I'm talking about the wildlife that you poached.
Yeah, that's what you say. You may have, but I was talking about all the wildlife you killed.
You've killed, yes.
And he smiled and said, good point.
Yeah.
It was kind of funny that this guy is out doing illegal things that you, as a game warden, have to come arrest him, mm-hmm, and he had wanted to be a game warden. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. After a break, Steve Callen and I will continue our conversation. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with author Steve Callen, a former wildlife protection officer. Also, at the end of that chapter, Stakeout at Battle Creek, you give the options. When you do arrest somebody, they have choices that they can make about whether they're going to cooperate or not. And so you laid out the options, said, here are your options. You can cooperate, and if somebody cooperates, what do you do?
Well, generally, if it's a simple situation, a lot of times you just write them a citation to appear in court, and they'll appear. And then other times, if it's a complicated case, we'll file a formal complaint against them with the district attorney, and then it'll go through a long process. But and then there's situations where they're just flat out not cooperating at all, and then we have to book them in jail.
Yeah, because if they've got ID, then you've got a way to contact them,
right,
know where they are. So you just ask them to show up. But if they don't cooperate, you book them and they go to jail.
And then they appear before the judge and they set a court date and they go through the whole process. So
So it's a lot easier if they cooperate, in
right.
other words.
For them and us.
Well, you mentioned that this guy couldn't pass the test to become a game warden. Mm-hmm. So I would like to ask you, what is involved in becoming a game warden? You have to go through training, and what was the training like when you, and where did you train?
When I was hired, the academy was at the Riverside Sheriff's Academy, which was down in Riverside, obviously. Usually what they did is there were a handful of wardens would be hired at the same time. And in my case, there were three, and we were assigned to go through this. I can't remember the exact length of it. It was a couple of months long, I think. And it was what they call it POST, Peace Officers Standards and Training. And in my case, there were three wardens and probably about at least 50 police officers and sheriff's deputies from various agencies down there in Southern California. So we all went through it together.
And there's a physical component and an academic
right,
component.
Right. It was basically half of the day was learning, you know, hand-to-hand combat and your shooting skills and arrest techniques, and then the other half was paperwork and sitting in the room and listening to lectures
and learning the law.
Penal code and fish and game, all the different codes. And
well, I noticed as I was reading your book, every time you would introduce a character or person, you would give, and usually he, his height and weight.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that that's an important factor. If you're going out with some big guy, or particularly if the person you're going to arrest or that you've got to confront is going to be this big bruiser, it helps to have a little heft to yourself.
Nine times out of ten, when you're by yourself, when you're dealing with anybody, a lot of times people are armed. And one of the things about a warden, he has to learn how to use his keep his wits about him and use good common sense in dealing with people. And most of the time, if you do that, you can accomplish what you want to accomplish without it escalating into any kind of confrontation where you have to actually physically arrest somebody.
In fact, I think most of us would assume that maybe being a policeman is the most dangerous law enforcement job. But you said that a DEA agent and a game warden are the most dangerous law enforcement jobs.
Statistically, that's one of the that was true. And some people might disagree with that, but there's a lot of danger involved in both jobs. And the reason the warden's job has become where it's so dangerous is because you're usually by yourself and you're an hour or two from the nearest backup. And that's particularly true these days. Some of the wardens these days, they call them fish and wildlife wardens instead of fish and game wardens.
They changed the name.
Yes, mm-hmm. Are dealing with these marijuana growers and Mexican cartels. They're dangerous criminals a lot of times, and they're heavily armed, and it's a whole new world. Some of the things that wardens are dealing with today.
Well, even when you were a warden, it was pretty scary.
It was pretty scary. Yes, sometimes.
Before you were called game wardens, they were called deputy commissioners,
mm-hmm.
And you quote the 1914 manual for deputies that was issued by the California Game Fish and Game Commission. And I thought, this is such, and you call this chapter sage advice. I thought, yeah, it really is. And here's what this manual for wardens who were called deputies then. Courageous but courteous is a qualification which goes far in making a good officer. A timid man can accomplish little. An overbearing one can do more harm than good. Clothed with all the power and authority of the highest peace officer in the state, there is no call for harshness on the part of the Deputy Fish and Game Commissioner. Direct, orderly, but firm should be the methods of an arresting officer. A bullying attitude provokes resistance. Not every offender of the game laws is a disreputable character or a dangerous citizen. Many game law violators are the result of thoughtless disregard rather than willful lawlessness. And while forcible resistance on the part of a prisoner may be overcome with force, the deputy can well be courteous to the last possible extremity. There may be times when swift, sure, and forceful must be the actions of a deputy, in which event a reputation for tact and courtesy will sustain him if criticized.
Good advice.
And I think you took that to heart because what was the award best when you went through the training?
Best overall officer. That's
best overall officer because you excelled in both the physical component and the academic component of the training.
Yes.
Yeah. And don't you think that would apply to not just you, but also you had a wonderful partner that you worked for years with, Dave Zodi.
Yes, I did. Dave and I started down on the Colorado River. He started about 6 months after I did, and we became lifelong friends and ended up working together for most of our 30-year careers.
And those qualities of being courageous but courteous, and you can't be timid, you can't get anything done if you're timid, but then if you're overly aggressive, that gets you nowhere either.
Exactly.
Well, this warden then in this book about sage advice and Dolahite.
Ned Dolahite.
And of course, you changed the name, so I'm guessing
that's his real name.
Oh, that's his real name.
Yes.
Okay, because you did, what you had to say about him was very nice. You say that his calm demeanor and skillful handling of a potentially volatile situation make him an excellent role model for wardens today. What was the instance when you had that remark about him?
It all started, and Ned lives in the same area where I live, and I happen to see him every once in a while. And I happened to, he was the chief of patrol or the head of law enforcement for the whole state for a good part of his career. And I happened to ask him, do you have any advice for these young wildlife wardens of today? And he sat me down. He says, well, let me tell you a little story. And he told me this story about when he started out as a fish and game warden in Tule Lake up on the northeastern end of California, and was working spotlighters one night all by himself. And these,
now you might explain what spotlighters are.
Well, spotlighters are basically people that shoot deer. They shine a light in the eyes of a deer.
You carry this handheld spotlight.
Yes, and the deer stops and is blinded by the light, and then they put a bullet between the deer's eyes, generally with a 22 rifle or a rifle. So anyway, these individuals were up there on the side of the hill, coming up the hill in a truck, and he stopped them and went. They didn't have a deer, but he asked to check their rifle, and instead of handing him the rifle that they should have, there was a man and a wife, and the man stepped out of the door, pushing the officer back a little bit, and the woman jumped out the passenger side of the car with the rifle, and this warden's, and he was a young warden at the time, all he could hear over there is this woman jacking shells in or out of the rifle, and so he demanded that the husband have his wife hand over the rifle, and they refused to do it. And she's out in the dark. He doesn't know where she is. And so he's thinking, first he looks in the back of the pickup to make sure they don't have a deer or there's no evidence of him having taken a deer. And he knows who these people are. So he just says, well, I'm going to give you one more chance to turn over the rifle. And they refused to do it. So he said, well, okay, well, I'll see you tomorrow morning. And he drove on down the road. And then the next morning he went and got a warrant for both their arrests, and this was in Alturas. And he and another officer and a female officer went and arrested them both and took them right before the judge, and they ended up, the man ended up spending 5 days in jail. So, and the rifle was forfeited. So, and nobody got, the object of that whole story was that instead of a gunfight out there in the dark or tussling over this gun, which—
So many ways you could make a wrong step.
So many ways that somebody could get seriously hurt or killed. Instead, both of them got what they had coming to them and nobody got hurt. So
he said, in the end, this couple, Virgil and Della Dobbs, were arrested for their crimes, had their day in court. More importantly, no one was hurt tussling over a rifle in the middle of the night or engaging in a needless shootout.
Exactly.
And there's so much now with video cameras so prevalent, you see where, oh gosh, that officer, policeman, of course, really didn't handle that well.
Doesn't that fit in with today's news, the things you see on today's news?
It's just about any day news when an officer just makes an unwise decision.
Every situation is different. Of course, there's other situations where the officer has no choice, but
Oh, yeah.
Lots of times, if you just step back a second, use good common sense, everybody comes out on top.
And that's what you say, that he skillfully handled what could have been a volatile situation, and therefore he was a good role model for wardens.
Right.
And you could add policemen, because he handled it so well. And in the end, nobody got hurt.
Right.
I might remind people, my guest is Steve Callan, and his latest book is The Game Warden's Son. His previous book was Badges, Bears, and Eagles, where he's told true life adventure stories of his life as a California fish and game warden. And I was wondering, Steve, with all these stories that you had, at what point did it occur to you, boy, I've got material for a book? As it turns out, two books.
Mm-hmm.
But the first book, I don't know if you knew at the time you were going to write two books.
No, the first book, basically, I had always said during my career that at some point of course, every officer says that at some point, but I had so many great stories, and I thought, well, I'm going to write this book. And I sat down and I wrote it, and I was fortunate to have a publisher up in Seattle pick it up and publish it. So the first book did well, and the second book, I had written a couple of chapters just because I was kind of fooling around one day, and I started writing chapters and thinking that maybe I would write another one, because it was actually more stories. I had 50 years of stories to tell from beginning at the time when my father became a fish and game warden, and I grew up as the great game warden's son, as the book title says. And those years that when I was growing up were about as exciting as a childhood could be. So I got to, my dad started out on the, he was assigned as the boarding officer on the patrol boat Marlin out of Long Beach down in Southern California. I got to go out to the Channel Islands on patrols.
Well, and I want to ask you that after I come back from a break. I want to ask you about growing up with a father who was a game warden, because that is the title of your most recent book, The Game Warden's Son. But I was just wondering at what point you then realized that you had material for a book. Did it just dawn on you one day, or were you kind of collecting making notes along the way?
I had been making notes along the way, and like I said, after about the second chapter I had written, which was basically when I was a boy growing up, the publishers contacted me and said, you know, your book has done real well. Do you have a sequel in you? And I said, well, as a matter of fact, I do, and I've already started on it. This time I've got 50 years of stories rather than the first book was more or less about my generation of wardens and my own stories. And then this one I started back in my dad's generation and told some of his stories also. So, yeah.
Well, you know what I found heartwarming, actually, was that writing this book provided you an opportunity, it seemed to me, to renew acquaintances, because you mentioned going back and talking to the people who were still alive.
Mm-hmm.
You went back and talked to them 30, 40 years later. To me, it seemed like you were saying, do I have this straight now? Is this how you remember it? And do I have all this right? So it gave you a chance to renew acquaintances from years past. But also, you had to have had access to written records, because you couldn't have just recalled all this detail.
A lot of the stories that I had, I had notes and rest reports basically from my experiences. And then the other officers that I wrote about some of the officers that worked the ocean, you know, in different marine situations. And they provided me with a lot of the information from big cases that they had made, because I got into abalone and lobsters and a lot of things that I didn't have the opportunity to work. So I vicariously enjoyed it through them and then wrote stories about their situations.
My guest is Stephen Callan, and he has written a second book. His first book, Badges, Bears, and Eagles, was very successful. He recounted his adventures as a California fish and game warden in that book. And now his book, The Game Warden's Son, he goes back to when he was growing up with a father who was a game warden. And I'd like for you to tell us, when you got old enough for your dad to say, hey, Steve, you want to come with me?
Well, the first time was when I was 11 years old, the first time I got to go out with him. That was when he was on the boat, on the Marlin, and they patrolled the Channel Islands. And I went on a memory.
Because you grew up in Southern California.
This was in Southern California. I grew up in San Diego, and then when he was hired by Fish and Game, we lived in Westminster down in near Long Beach. And that's where the boat was out of Seal Beach. So they would patrol out to the Channel Islands. And I got to go on a three-day trip with them on this one occasion. And so I wrote about that experience. When it's kind of a long, drawn-out story, but I learned a whole lot about ecology from two famous scientists with the National Park Service on that particular trip. And then also my dad and the other officers on board got involved in a big lobster case, which I witnessed and got to write about also.
Well, I could actually go back before that, because you had a grandmother who was ahead of her time, it seems to me.
Exactly.
What was her background? What was your family background,
by the way? My dad grew up in San... His mother, her name was Ann. She was a real lover of wildlife and nature, and so when I was young here in San Diego, every time that we would go to visit my grandmother, she would take us to the San Diego Zoo, because she was a lifelong member of the San Diego Zoological Society. So I just learned to love nature and wildlife at that point, and also the fact that we lived right on a canyon there in San Diego. This was before it was all developed and everything. And I basically grew up in those canyons, learning about, you know, snakes and lizards and everything that live there. And so when my dad became a game warden, it was an easy transition for me. And it was like a storybook childhood, you might say.
It sounds like every boy's dream to me.
Exactly.
Does, from this point of view. And you actually say your grandmother, Ann, was born in 1895 to Norwegian immigrants. And she herself had an eventful childhood. And she said her father was 6'4" entrepreneur who left Norway and came to America in 1893. And I might mention, you're 6 feet yourself, so you have that tall gene from your Northern European ancestors. And you do mention all along in your stories that people's height and weight. But also, you know something interesting too, and it was totally unrelated to your family's being outdoor types, and that is your grandma Anne sometimes mentioned a lifelong friend and bus riding companion named May Williams.
Yes.
And you say May worked for the Salvation Army. And grandma said that May frequently talked about her son Teddy during their bus rides.
I know. That was quite a thrill. Yeah, she actually was a good friend of May Williams, who was the mother of Ted Williams, you know, the famous baseball player.
Boston Red Sox baseball player.
They lived in the same section of San Diego at the time. My grandmother lived on Cherokee Avenue in San Diego, and I'm not sure the exact street that Ted and his mother and them, they lived, but it was in the neighborhood. And so my grandmother would actually see Ted walking down the street batting rocks with a stick, and she was always worried about him breaking a window or something. So,
well, and I say it was unrelated to your career as a game warden, but you actually were quite successful as a softball player yourself. So you must have played a lot of baseball yourself when you were a kid.
Played baseball, and then when I got older, started playing softball and stayed playing softball clear to this day. I'm still playing on a senior team out of Los Angeles.
Yeah, in 2004, you were inducted into the National Senior Softball Hall of Fame. And since college, you've played competitive softball all over the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So that was something you remembered. Gosh, my grandmother knew Ted Williams.
Well, she didn't know. I don't know how well she knew Ted, but she knew her mother.
His mother. Yeah. But you said he would see him going down the street batting balls.
That was before he was famous.
So let's go on then to your father. And he didn't start out as a game warden.
My dad was a fireman on San Diego Fire Department, and then in 1958 he took the test and was offered a job as the warden and boarding officer on the boat the Marlin, and then
he was in his early 30s at this time.
Yes, and then two years later, my parents had decided that they wanted to raise their three boys in a small town atmosphere, and L.A. was growing by leaps and bounds, so my dad transferred to Orland right here in the Sacramento Valley, 20 miles from Chico here.
Yeah.
And
so you grew up in Orland.
And so
you
for the next 10
years. Went to Chico
years,
State. You got your undergraduate degree from Chico
exactly.
State University.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so for the next 10 years, we lived here, and I graduated from Chico State. And I wrote about several adventures that my dad had in this area also.
Well, what else did you enjoy about being the son of a game warden?
Well, I got to do some things that you wouldn't even couldn't imagine today. As I became a teenager and we got a little, I got a little older, I was able to go out on some of the night patrols, and one in particular I wrote about. So,
is that the one where the guy said, "You brought your son along"?
Yeah, yeah.
What are you thinking? He didn't say those words now, but that's
kind of
what it was implied.
Like, I see you brought your kid with you.
Yeah.
That was, in fact, the fellow that said that was a longtime warden here in Chico for many years. And so that particular night we did a stakeout, and I call that chapter Greenheads and Muddy Sneakers, because greenheads being mallard, Drake mallards, and muddy sneakers being that the duck poachers at the time would wear, and they were usually young people, and they wore tennis shoes so they could run away real fast. And so anyway, so I won't give away the story, but that was quite an exciting night.
Well, but we've got to tell you something about it now, because this guy comes out and he says, "Hey, Steve, why don't you come with me?" And you think, "Oh, well, I guess he's not such a bad guy after all. He's not an old grumpy guy. He invited me to come along." But it wasn't so exciting.
I was going to follow my dad out in the field after these guys that had there were some shots that were heard the night we were out there. We're out on the levee there and down in Willows there around in the rice fields and just outside of the Sacramento Wildlife Refuge. And they're looking for what they call duck draggers, which were basically these poachers that would sneak up on big, large flocks of ducks at night and fire into the flocks. So I was about ready to go with my dad when this other officer says, "Well, why don't you just come with me?" And so I'm thinking, "Oh, okay, I'll go with you."
But I would think you're kind of flattered, because
yeah,
at first seemed
thinking,
to resent the fact that you came along.
He's never been nice to me before. Now he's asked me to come along. So we go down the road about a half a mile, he starts getting all this gear ready, puts his boots on, and gets ready to leave. And so I climb out of the car, and like I'm going to go with him. I had my hip boots on already. He says, "Oh, no, I want you to sit here and watch my car for me. That's the only reason I invited you, so you can watch my car." So anyway, that's how that started.
Well, and you don't want to give away the surprise
I was going to say the rest is pretty exciting after that.
It was. In fact, I thought you came out being a hero, and the others didn't view it that way.
In one way, I did, in the sense that they made a big case as a result of what happened.
Your having your eyes and ears open.
And the other way, I didn't follow the rules.
Didn't do what you were told to do.
I didn't do what
Steve.
I was told, so I learned a valuable lesson there. So,
yeah, so on the one hand, you didn't do what you were told, but you ended up helping them solve the case.
Solve a big duck case. So.
Yeah. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. After a break, Steve Callen and I will continue our conversation. I mentioned this person named Sandberg. Now, is that his real name, too?
Yes.
Since I thought maybe it might be, because he's a really interesting character. He has an interesting job description. Tell us about Mr. Sandberg, because he is a little different in that he is not limited just to California.
Right. He was a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Agent.
U.S., United States.
United States Federal, Fish and Wildlife Agent.
As opposed to just California, which you and your coworkers
were. Right. They would be assigned to a certain area, but a lot of times, like instead of just working in California, he'd be called on to go up in Alaska or work in southern Oregon or in Arizona, depending on what the situation. Joe, in particular, had worked cases in where they were killing bighorn sheep in Arizona, or he'd been working cases where they were killing walruses in Alaska. You know, it's all kinds of different situations. So it was pretty.
But now he
job.
Didn't wear a uniform like your dad did.
No, he was I think most of his career was undercover, and in situations where he's working in a covert capacity, and he had to deal with a lot of really dangerous people. Had they known that he was actually an officer,
not who he said he was. In fact, it was actually funny that he has this guy coming out with him. This guy comes decked out with his Roy Rogers outfit. And what was the matter with the cap this guy was wearing? Joe have to say about that?
A situation where one of the supervisors had come up with the idea of taking the and put a tape.
And he's going along with Ed. Now,
yeah,
Ed's this, all in disguise, so to speak.
This officer
he's undercover.
Right.
Ed's undercover. He's U.S. And this guy comes along, and what was the problem?
He had a baseball cap, but in the brim of the cap was this tape recorder.
So it can't be a normal looking brim if it's got a tape recorder.
It had to be about a half inch thick, you know. So it's kind of like obvious. And so Joe sees that thing and says, "What are you doing with this thing?"
He has to take him aside.
And throws it back in the back of the car and hands him an old baseball cap that somebody had sat on with a Giants insignia on it. So he said, "This is a little better. Put this on."
Yeah, because they're going to be around people who would be suspicious.
Sure.
What's this guy doing here? Is he a cop?
Yeah, what's this?
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want it.
If you're undercover.
Exactly. When you're working undercover, the best undercover officer is the one that nobody pays any attention to. They don't even have a clue that
you've got to blend in.
You just
got
to
dress
blend
like
in.
The other people.
Yeah, and look and sound like the other people. So those are all things that different people had to learn if they're going to work undercover. So
he fortunately had some spare clothes that he said,
yeah,
"Here, put this on."
So he said, "Well, am I going to have to dress you from now on when we work together?" That worked out pretty well.
Another thing that, speaking of Ed Sandberg, is that Joe. These cases aren't just solved within a few days or weeks or months. These take a long time to put together a case. That was very evident in your first book,
mm-hmm.
Badges, Bears, and Eagles, where you worked on a case, I think, 3 years.
3 years, yes.
To gather all the evidence and put it all together. And Mr. Sandberg is working on several cases at once because they don't all get resolved neatly, like a TV program where everything's tied up in an hour.
Exactly. He had two or three cases going on at the same time. He'd be working one guy undercover, you know, hand in hand, and then another guy he's dealing with on the phone that lives in Colorado and who's buying and selling, you know, bear gallbladders from another state. And so he got really good at what he did, and it really was effective. So he'd get asked by supervisors to work other cases while he was working his primary case.
And even though he was U.S., he would get help from the California game wardens.
A lot of times, yes. That's how I got to know him.
Yeah, and so at that time, you say he was 41. He was working undercover for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and he was working since 1979. And what he said was, he was telling you this, Joe was telling you this. He said, "What have you been up to, Joe?" I asked. And he said, "Well, the usual. I'd rather be out busting poachers with you guys. You know, Steve, you and Dave are my favorite state game wardens." And you said, "Oh, shucks, Joe. I bet you tell that to all the state game wardens."
Which he did, I think.
Well, since he brought up Dave, and we mentioned him indirectly a little bit ago, tell us about Dave.
Well, Dave, like I said, Dave and I had known each other for 30 years. He worked in the desert with me, and then later on when I promoted and went to Riverside, he transferred up to the North Coast over in the Eureka area.
In fact, you kind of met in an unlikely place.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that. We actually were taking upper division classes at Sacramento State University and around the 1972, somewhere around there, and— we actually ended up in the same zoology class and talked at the time about what our career goals were. And
because this is before you even either of you had careers.
I didn't know him from Adam, yeah. And he said he wanted to be a game warden, but if he couldn't be a game warden, he wanted to be a park ranger. And so as it turned out, I had the same goals. And as it turned out, I ended up working for Sacramento County Parks, and he ended up working for parks down in the Bay Area. And
so you met in this zoology class. You each go your separate ways, and
then before you know it, I was hired by Fish and Game, and my first assignment was down on the Colorado River in a place called Earp.
Mm-hmm. E-A-R-P.
As in Wyatt Earp. Mm-hmm. And Dave was hired 6 months later, and his assignment was in Blythe, which was 50 miles south of me, so we became adjoining wardens, and the rest is history, kind of. And we worked together for our whole careers, pretty much. Mm-hmm.
So where else, from having gotten together down there, and then you both ended up here?
Yes.
Northern California.
I transferred from Riverside. I was a lieutenant in Riverside for 3.5 years, and then I transferred up to Redding when an opening came up in Redding. And Dave was over on the coast in the Fortuna, Eureka area, and then he transferred back over to my squad a couple years after that. And so for the next 20-some years, we worked together again. So it worked out pretty well.
Well, when I hear about the story and the things that you and Dave did together, I couldn't help imagining a TV series, because you certainly got enough stories.
Oh, yes.
And you do such a good job with your dialogue, Steve. Where did that come from? I mean, this was not part of your training as far as I know.
You just put yourself in the situation that you were in, and pretty much that's what was said, or that's as near as possible what would have been said at the time, and that's how I use the it's pretty accurate. Everybody I've talked to, all the officers that are involved in those books, both of them have said that you hit the nail right on the head. That's exactly what the way it happened and what happened. So and that's one of my big concerns whenever I write. I always want to make sure that the officers I describe, I don't try to make them look like great heroes. I try to make them look like it the way they really were. And so that's real important to me.
And sometimes the conversation will be going on, just like a realistic conversation. They'll be talking about something and you'll say, by the way, you know your dashboard's falling off. And
oh, exactly. That's what happened.
Yeah, and it's not related to the facts of the case. It's just like a normal conversation would be.
There were several situations with Dave there where we'd be working in. And like his first car was this old jalopy that they assigned him. It was a Nash Rambler or something. And I remember he had the dash was coming off, and he'd have piles of Fish and Game codes and everything up on the dash, and then they'd all go flying off when he turned the corner. And and so we had quite an adventure together. It was pretty a lot of fun.
My guest is Steve Callan, and he lives in Palo Cedro now. And he worked as a game warden for over 30 years. His first book, Badges, Bears, and Eagles, recounted adventures of his career as a California Fish and Game Warden. And now he has a second book, The Game Warden's Son, where he divides the sections of his book in decades. And you start with your father's decade, 50s, 60s, 60s, 70s, and you move through what your life was like going through those years. There's one thing that I haven't asked you about, Steve, because you didn't mention it in your first book, but you, I don't know if you still do Nixon impressions.
Probably most of the young people now don't even know who Richard Nixon was, so I gave that up. But at the time I was going through the academy, I used to mess around a little bit, and it was good for laughs sometimes.
Well, because things are pretty serious. You say that Sergeant Peterson caught me doing Richard Nixon impressions at the back of a formation one morning and ordered me to come up to the cement stage and perform for the entire class. Now let's see how well you fish cops do push-ups, said the sergeant when I finished my performance.
So, I remember that like it was yesterday, yes.
And you said, I think I surprised him when I knocked out 30 quick ones on my fingertips. Mm-hmm. And he said, that'll be enough entertainment for today. Yeah. Get back in formation. So you could do that many push-ups on your fingertips?
Yeah, that was a long time ago. That was many years ago. So at the time, I tried to stay in pretty good shape. And I was pretty much prepared for the job when I started. So.
Yeah, so that's why you excelled both in the being right. good at the physical training and the academics when you were in training. This second book, I do want to ask you about this, Steve, it's touching that you dedicate this book to your brother, and he died in 2010. And what were the circumstances?
Well, my brother developed Alzheimer's. In fact, he was a businessman here in Chico for many years. And when he was about 45 years old, he started developing symptoms of Alzheimer's where he couldn't remember things and forgetful. And he had it for almost 15 years before he finally passed away. And he was only like 61 years old when he passed away. And now my father has the same thing, and so we're going through the same thing with my dad.
Of course, your dad's a lot older.
Yeah, my dad will be 90 this year, so he's lived a pretty good life. So.
Yeah, but when you're asking your dad about things or taking him places, for example, the very last chapter in your book, you return to Plaskett Meadows.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a dedication to my dad in a way. And I began the book with my dad, and then I wanted to end with my dad also. And so about 3 years ago, I picked him up and I said, you know, you've always wanted to go back to Plaskett Meadows where we had so much fun when you were working in Orland. And so I took him and we drove about a half day's drive up there from Reading and spent the day up there. And of course, different course of events took place up there, but we had a chance to talk, and it was pretty exciting. And then there actually turned out to be a couple of fishermen up there at the time, and I remember jokingly said, "Dad, you want to go over there and check your fishing licenses?" And he still understood the joke at the time. So,
Because on the front page of your book, you have a photograph of you as a kid with your dad in his uniform, mm-hmm. and on the back of your book, you have a photograph of you and your dad when you're older with your arm around your dad.
It was pretty nice for me because I had ridden along with him all those years when I was growing up.
It's been such a pleasure talking to you, Steve, about your latest book. And we also touched on your earlier book was Badges, Bears, and Eagles. Your new book, The Game Warden's Son. And I might remind people that you will be signing books tomorrow at the Chico Costco. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.